Saving $100,000 before you turn 25 is very impressive, but Tori Dunlap wants us to think about money as more than just a bank balance. Money gives women in particular choices, big choices about having children and leaving a bad relationship or a bad job. That's what she did. She walked away from a job she hated and started a financial education empire called Her First 100K. She calls herself the financial feminist, coaching millions of women on how to negotiate better salaries, pay off debt, and save money through her popular TikTok videos and podcast. She's now written her first book. It's called Financial Feminist: Overcome the Patriarchy's Bullpucky to Master Your Money and Build a Life You Love. And Tori Dunlap joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Bullpucky is sending me sending me away. That was so great. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's a New Zealandism, but people can guess the missing word. I love this quote that sums up your sums up financial feminism. You say, when you have all you need, build a longer table, not a higher fence. Would you mind unpacking a bit of that for us?
Yeah, so in writing this book, one of the biggest things that I had trouble with was identifying the balance between, okay, well, I'm going to write a finance book with actionable resources for individuals, but in the vast, you know, landscape of all of this, individual choices are not really the reason people don't have money, right? Yet the vast majority of people are telling you that the reason you're not rich is because you don't work hard, right? These finance experts, and at least in the States here, we have like Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman, right, who are actively shaming you if you don't have money. But in practicality, the reason you're not rich is systemic oppression. It's racism or sexism, or, you know, it's a disability that makes it difficult to navigate the workforce. And there's a lot of systemic factors at play. And so I was trying to reckon as an author in writing Financial Feminist with, okay, I'm still going to write this book that talks about all of these resources, right? All of the things we can do at the individual level. But what does that mean for society? What does that mean for, you know, actual capital C change? And the quote that I've always loved that ended up grounding the work in this book was the one you just read: when you have all you need, build a longer table, not a higher fence. This idea for financial feminism is, if I can get my financial foundation in order, if I can learn how to save money and pay off debt and navigate the system that does exist, then I can start not only inviting people to a table, but I can start building a table of my own. So we talk about more in the book too, this idea of like airplane finances, right? You've put on your own oxygen mask so you can help others. We also want to start using our resources to build a plane where everybody does get an oxygen mask. So taking care of yourself, learning how to navigate the financial system so that because you're taken care of, when you have all you need, you can build this, you know, longer table as opposed to gatekeeping that wealth and abundance.
Did you have a moment where you kind of changed your money mindset, particularly ahead of hitting that incredible $100,000 by age 25?
It was definitely a change, but it's probably not the one you'll expect. I grew up with parents who were very frugal, who didn't grow up with a lot themselves, and so who were making really, really smart financial choices. And I learned the same from them. And I later discovered, and I say this in my work, that it was a privilege to have that financial education. And with that privilege came responsibility. So actually, one of the things I had to learn was how to like lay off the gas pedal a little bit. I was so focused on, you know, building a solid foundation for myself and making the smart financial choices, that when it came time for me to decide if I wanted to run Her First 100K full time, to be a full time entrepreneur, I actually found that to be a huge risk. I had a million reasons why I shouldn't do that, because I saw my parents always choose the stable option. And so in that progression towards the 100K goal, that $100,000 for me was like the permission slip I needed to quit my job. Yet I had achieved that 100K goal and had still not quit my job yet. And so I started realizing that, oh, even these like positive, you know, money memories or this money mindset can potentially turn into, you know, a negative reality for you if you believe that this thing is risky or scary, but still worth doing. I joke all the time that I call my parents now and I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that I didn't take your advice to keep my job no matter what, because that was what they were telling me. They were telling me, keep your job no matter what. You need that 9 to 5. You need your health insurance. You need your stability. And of course, I make way more money. I have a way bigger impact on the world. I get to give people jobs, and there's so much expansiveness that gets to happen. But we spend in the entire first chapter of my book, Financial Feminist, talking about the emotions of money, because a lot of people go, okay, I need to figure out a budget. I need to figure out a plan, but they end up sabotaging themselves because they haven't learned to understand what sort of narratives are at play. What sort of beliefs do you have? And so I ended up realizing that even though I had this great financial education of frugality and stability, it actually could potentially also, you know, limit my options and prevent me from making a calculated risk that ended up paying off for me in a huge way.
Wow. It sounds like it's kind of learning the sweet spot of when to put the foot on the accelerator and when to pump the brakes.
Yeah. And I think we either have, you know, way too much of one,
yeah,
or we haven't understood that there can be a balance, right? Like I was talking about before, all these financial experts are saying, you know, oh, you're spending too much money and that's why you can't build wealth. And it's like, I don't want a life myself where all I do is save my money. And I don't want people to live in that reality either. And I don't want you to also feel ashamed if you spend, you know, any money, even if you have a small amount of money, right? That a lot of people come to me and they're like, I feel ashamed because I don't make a lot of money. And then I end up spending, you know, what I do have. And I'm like, of course. And of course that you have to spend, you know, the money you have on your basic necessities. Mm. And so, you know, all of these are, these sort of narratives or these beliefs that are fostered and perpetuated by society. And I can speak as an American, but I know that this is the reality for most countries, is that the, you know, the narrative about talking about money is taboo, right? This narrative that, oh, you shouldn't talk about money. It's gauche. It's impolite. It's tacky. This is something that is perpetuated to keep marginalized groups underpaid and overworked. And one of the easiest things you can do to start changing the reality, not only for yourself, but for society, is to start having those conversations. And once you start to, again, unpack, oh, these are the narratives I've meant to believe. This is how my parents managed money. This is, you know, how I've seen other people talk to me about money, even financial experts, and it made me feel weird or ashamed. Then you can start truly making a financial plan that feels sustainable, that feels joyful, that feels abundant rather than, you know, limiting or scarce or, you know, this feeling of fear and intimidation.
I've got a friend who is a feminist, brilliant, strong. She's articulate, smart, all the right things. And yet, whenever the topic of money comes up, she tells me she starts feeling nauseous and will do anything to change the subject. Yeah. Is that a common problem?
Oh, God, yes. And I mean, you've given the perfect example, right? It's not, I don't know. I think we have this unfortunate misconception that it's like, oh, you know, we won't talk about money because, you know, we feel like we're not smart enough to have that conversation. Yeah. And a lot of people feel that way who are very, very intelligent. We have a member of our investing education platform. I remember in the early days, she's like, I am a doctor, right? Like I went to many, many years of school. I am very, very intelligent and very capable. And yet I am terrified to have any sort of conversation for potentially feeling stupid, potentially feeling ashamed, but also because we've been told again that it is tacky. We are actually more likely as a society to have a conversation about money than we'll talk about sex, than we'll talk about religion or politics or even death. We'll talk about anything before we'll talk about money. And we're actually recording this on Equal Pay Day here in the United States. Huh. And for me, when I think about like Equal Pay Day, in addition to, you know, of course, really important systemic change like paid family leave in the United States and, you know, conquering and working to overcome racism and sexism and ableism and everything else. It's also like the way we get equal pay is we start talking about money. We start talking about our salaries. We start admitting that we're maybe a little scared and intimidated by the amount of debt we have. We start celebrating the wins that we do have. But if Brené Brown has this great quote that shame lives in shadow. And so, you know, the more we avoid having these conversations, the more ashamed we feel. And therefore it's a cyclical thing, right? Okay, I feel shame, so I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not talking about it, so I feel more shame. I feel shame. So, you know, it continues and continues. So if you're listening, one of the actual most radical things you can do that's very, very easy is just start having honest conversations with people you trust about money.
Love that. I'm talking to Tori Dunlap. Her book is called Financial Feminist: Overcome the Patriarchy's Bullpucky to Master Your Money and Build a Life You Love. In order to get your finances in order, Tori, is it necessary or desirable to get some of your emotion-based issues in order as well? Are they linked?
Yeah, we were talking about this before. 100,000%. They are 100% linked. Yeah, this is often the thing that gets overlooked. One of the reasons I wrote Financial Feminist is I either saw books that talked about all of the emotions and talked about all of the systemic pieces and then went, okay, you're kind of SOL, have fun. And then you're like, okay, what do I need to do? You've unearthed all this trauma for me, but I have no way forward, right? How do I actually use the things I've learned to change my life? Or the other books I saw completely sidepassed or sideswept the emotional part of money because it was sticky and complicated in a very gray area. And instead we're just like, here's how to get a budget together. And you have to have both. You have to start understanding what sort of emotional hangups you have about money. So we spend the longest chapter of the book, which is the first chapter, before we get a spending plan together, before we learn how to pay off debt, before we set financial goals, before we learn how to invest. You have to understand what sort of narratives you've been believing about money, mm-hmm. right? We were talking about money as taboo. That's a narrative that we believe about money. We believe, especially in the United States, that, if you're working hard, you should just have money, right? It's this American bootstraps narrative, which of course is not true. We have plenty of people who are working desperately hard, but have very little to show for it. And that's not their fault. We guide people through a practice that I think has been so impactful and would actually be really interesting if you're willing to share yours. I ask people what their first money memory is. What is the first time they remember thinking about money or considering money? And how does that, you know, play a part in their life now? For me, it was saving money, saving any like change I could find in a Altoids tin so I could go see Annie the Musical because I was a huge theater nerd. My mom had told me, okay, if you want tickets to this thing, I was probably 5 or 6 years old, right? If you want tickets to go see Annie, you need to be putting money away. You need to be saving. And of course, what I learned from that is I can't live beyond my means. I have to save money for the things I want. So if you're willing to share, it might be interesting to actually hear yours.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much kind of to learn from this, but I think it might be an early Christmas where for the first time relations, instead of giving me presents, just gave me cash. And I suddenly found myself quite flush, you know, maybe 40, yeah. 50, 60 bucks and didn't know what to spend it on because I've been entirely looked after by my parents until then. But also I felt compelled to spend it as quickly as possible because that's what you do with money, right? You then exchange it for something else. So I didn't save it. I went and bought it, spent it on books, which is at least something positive. But yeah, it's a series of incidents like that before you're on your own and suddenly realize that the buck stops with you, literally, and you've got to start taking responsibility. And you make an incredible point, which is that, well, you talk about women, when we as women are told to just be magically good with money, even though no one taught us, we're then scared to ask questions for fear of seeming dumb or naive. It's such a powerful point, and like, how do you overcome it? I guess by talking about it.
Yeah, and also realizing that you have to give yourself grace. I didn't come out of the womb speaking fluent Italian or learning how to play the tuba, right? So why should I expect to be good at money?
Yeah.
It's the same thing, right? We expect we have a good with money gene or we don't. And weirdly, we don't expect that for most other things, right? Like if I put on a pair of roller skates and tried to, you know, roll around my block, I'm going to fall on my face. I'm going to fall on my butt, right? That's going to happen. But yet we don't have that same grace for ourselves when we're thinking about money. We just expect to either be magically good or terrible. And we're not patient enough to see the process because we feel deeply ashamed. And you were talking about before another point, and I make in the book where you get to a point where suddenly you realize like, oh, it is all me. Like all of these responsibilities are mine, right? Like what if I mess up? What if I make a bad call? What if I mismanage my money? Oh, I'm so terrible at this, right? And you have a beautiful opportunity to either go, oh God, it's all me, or wow, it's all me. It is all me. I get to make the decisions I want to make. I get to manage my money and spend my money and save my money on the things that are important to me. And unless, you know, you might be managing money with a romantic partner, but you get to say, wow, I get to use money as a tool to build an incredible life and a life that is mine, not somebody else's, right? Like, you know, I've made certain decisions in my life that may shock a lot of people financially. I have enough money to buy a house, yet I have not purchased property because that fits with my life. Mm. And a lot of people on paper would say, oh, that's throwing money away, right? You renting is throwing money away. And for me, it's actually gives me a lot of flexibility. It fits where I'm at in my lifestyle right now. I get to call somebody else if the pipes burst at 2 a.m. And that's my life, right? That's my money. That's my choice. And there's something actually really beautiful about that mindset shift, as opposed to like, oh God, it's all me, to wow, it's all me. I get to call all the shots.
One thing, you know, you're talking about encouraging women in particular to talk about money, not to treat it as a taboo topic. I wonder if one problem is that we tend to talk about money when there's a problem. And maybe that shouldn't sure. shouldn't be the only time the conversation starts.
I think sometimes it's easier to start a conversation when things are going badly. I don't really care how you start talking about money. I just hope that you do. Okay. But there is something like comforting again about maybe somebody admitting to you, you know, I feel really ashamed about my amount of debt. And if you have debt, you're going to suddenly feel so seen and thankful to that person for being vulnerable first. So if you haven't started having money conversations and you'd like to have more of them, leading with that vulnerability is huge, right? Offering, you know, something potentially a little vulnerable first with somebody you trust and expecting that they're going to match you in that. I will say as well, I'm obligated to speak that women talking about money is so key, but I find men are already talking about money. Men are typically more comfortable having conversations about their salary or their stocks performance. And if, you know, if you are a feminist man out there, or if you are, you know, committed to closing the inequality gaps for members of marginalized groups, you have a responsibility to start having money conversations with people who, you know, may not look like you. For me as a white woman, I have a responsibility to start having conversations about money, or to continue having conversations with, you know, my women of color colleagues, with my disabled colleagues. So that's actually one of the most powerful things that someone who, you know, is in the social status quo can do. Bring that person into a meeting, tell them, hey, I think you're getting underpaid because I'm getting paid this, or I know this person's getting paid this because, you know, there was some scuttlebutt, right? It's so powerful for you to be able to use that privilege and that power to actually bridge those inequality gaps with your efforts.
We've been talking in generalities a lot today, which is good stuff. But I also want to point out that there's quite practical tips in your book, and yeah. I really like the way you talk about Netflix, for example, paying for Netflix. You're not yeah. saying, hey, there's no way you can get ahead unless you cut back on all this frivolous spending. But you do encourage people to look at subscriptions in a particular way.
Yeah, really with all spending. Again, we have an entire chapter on spending in the book. And one of the things I say repeatedly in that chapter is you don't need to stop spending money, but I need you to stop spending money on things you don't care about, right? So if you get a lot of joy out of your Netflix subscription, great. There is absolutely no reason to cancel that. But if you are subscribed to something, right, that you haven't logged in months, or you've completely forgotten about, I would rather you take your very hard-earned money, because you worked really hard for that money, and spend it on something you really love instead. I joke that, like, we are leaving lukewarm behind. Like, it's 2023. Our lives need to be piping hot in every aspect of our lives, right? Like, I want a really healthy romantic relationship. I want great friendships. I want to show up for myself. I want my money working really hard for me to give me the most kick-ass life possible. So I think that one of the things we can really focus on when it comes to spending is, rather than feeling like, oh, I need to deprive myself, I need to cut everything, it's more, what am I spending my money on that makes me feel lukewarm, or that I only kind of care about? And instead, either save the money or spend it on things that really light me up. So we identify what we call the three value categories in that chapter. They're the three areas in your life that do light you up, that do bring you the most joy. So for me, my three are travel. I was just mentioning I had visited New Zealand a couple months ago and spent money to do that, which was incredible. Travel, food out. I love going to restaurants. I'm a huge foodie. And plants. And you can't see it, but I'm in my office with 15 plants just in this room. Everything else I kind of care about, but not really, right? So like I will buy an occasional sweater or an occasional coffee, right? But that's not where the majority of my money is going. So a practice that everyone listening can do is figure out what are the three areas in my life where I want the majority of my discretionary money to go? What is going to bring me the most joy? And if it's not bringing you joy, it's time to cut it.
Great. And I'll just supply this quote also from the book because I love it. If you're giving Netflix more money than you are giving future you, I need you to give
Yeah.
yourself the $14. I love that. And it's not just Netflix, obviously, it's any sort of any subscription. It's about
Yeah,
priority,
automated
right?
or and right, anything you've got on autopilot in your brain,
Yeah.
right? A lot of people think like, "Oh, I can't set aside an automatic transfer to boost my savings." But we have automatic transfers to pay bills for every aspect of our lives, right? Sometimes our rent's taken out automatically. Yeah, sometimes we're paying Netflix or some sort of automated subscription and it's deducting money from our account every month. And actually, you can apply the same thing to your savings. It's a very, very specific actionable tip is automate your savings. Set up an automatic transfer from your checking account to your savings account, even if that is just $20 a month. And so the point I make that you read is again, not necessarily canceling Netflix, but if you are giving this huge, multi-million, really billion-dollar corporation more money than you are setting aside for future you, I think you're at least, but probably more deserving of that money than Netflix is.
Finally, Tori, what do you think when I tell you money can't buy happiness?
I think it's BS. That's my edited response. Good for radio, but money can buy stability and safety. And for the vast majority of people, I think that's happiness. Now, of course, on paper, right? It's this idea of like, don't go buy a Ferrari in order to make you happy, right? That's not going to make you happy. But it does offer you choices. It offers you the choice to have kids or not have kids, to travel, to start a business, to get married or not get married, right? Every option opens up to you. So donate to causes you believe in, right? Every option opens up to you when you have money. And as someone who has money now and gets to also use that money to not only better my own life, but better the communities around me, I can 100% confirm for you that money does indeed buy happiness.
Hey, you did great work. Congratulations on the book. It's called Financial Feminist: Overcome the Patriarchy's Bullpucky to Master Your Money and Build a Life You Love. And I've been talking to the author, Tori Dunlap. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.